Right, well, I'm here at St Pancras Station, just about to board the Eurostar, going to Lille and Bruxelles, it says on the train. Off to Brussels for a few days, so we're going to be doing a lot of things at the European Parliament. We've got a lot of meetings lined up. I'll see what I can do in the way of persuading people to go online, join our podcast. And the guy's waving his flag. He's telling me to get on board, so I'd better go. Yep, sign in again when we get there.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Brussels. We will soon be arriving at Brussels Midi Station, where this journey ends. On behalf of the team, I wish you a pleasant evening, and we all hope to see you again soon on Eurostar.
Right, well, I've arrived at Brussels Midi Station, got off the Eurostar. It's one of these modern stations, all glass and stainless steel and bright lights. Anyway, I'm being met by Lottie, who came here ahead of me. Lottie, what have we got lined up for this trip?
Oh, we've got lots of meetings lined up with various MEPs from all the political parties. But I think first thing we need to do is go and get a drink.
That sounds like a brilliant idea to me. Right, lay on Macduff to the nearest bar. Right, we've arrived at the Carlos Quintus Bar in Place Luxembourg. We've met Stephen Wolf. Nice to meet you, Stephen.
Good evening.
Hello. Now, one of the things that... well, thanks for the beer. That's the first thing that I've got to say. But one of the things that you said when we first sat down is that you've been looking at the TTIP document, and I know a lot of people are very concerned about this and possible impact on NHS. How do you see that shaping up?
Well, as it's very clear today through the leak of TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership Agreement, wants to be signed between the EU and the USA, is that it will have a devastating effect on the NHS. It's very clear that you're going to see large corporations being able to privatise parts of the NHS, but the document is actually much worse than we thought.
Oh, yeah.
Firstly, the large pharmaceutical companies would have a huge opportunity to take out smaller pharmaceutical companies. In terms of farming, you would have GM products thrust upon all of those organic farms across Europe. Right. And also, you are selling out small farmers to allow huge commercial farming interests to take over not just Britain, but vast swathes of Europe, just to do a deal to enable German and Swedish and French car manufacturing to be able to sell their cars into America.
So is that what you think is actually the driving force between this? It's French and German car industry is pushing for this deal because they want to get into the American market.
Well, I think it's two things. It's the trade-off by the European Union that seems to support those manufacturing companies that predominantly look German, once again.
Yep.
And the large corporations, through something such as the licensing elements, particularly the licensing in wine, the licensing in terms of food, and the licensing into of other areas, that would actually make sure that the large corporates have a huge power over small, medium-sized businesses that are trying to grow, build their products, and sell them off. This isn't a free trade agreement by any means whatsoever. Yes, the tariffs have gone, but by the use of secondary regulation, the changes in the rules is going to make small, medium-sized businesses all across Europe come under the yoke of large corporations.
But I mean, this is something that's been a problem at the European Union for some time, that it's geared up for the big companies, the big trade unions, the big public sector bodies. And small and medium-sized businesses and the people who work for them are very often disadvantaged by the sort of lobbying and the legislation that's coming out of here.
Yeah, well, we've always known that the large lobbyists have the great opportunity. Why the hell do you think that Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan are putting six-figure sums of money into the campaign to support the Remain group, yet there are small and medium-sized financial services businesses, such as those who the 100 names of the City of London people who signed a letter saying that we want to leave the European Union. It tends to be the entrepreneurs and those who are trying to build businesses that want to leave, rather than those which are the big corporates that want to stay. Now, that suits bureaucrats because they know that they can deal with people on the same level as they see it, and they don't have to deal with thousands of smaller companies and think of rules that actually help people grow.
Well, that's right. And I mean, you know, of course, we're moving into the final stages of the referendum campaign now. And I think one thing that really is quite clear, you know, us are better off out. We've been getting a lot of donations coming in from our members, and it's lots and lots of small donations coming in. Where, as you quite rightly say, the Stay campaign has got a few big corporate donors as far as we can make out. But you're a UKIP member of the European Parliament. I know you're heavily involved in the UKIP campaign to get us out in the referendum. Are your members very supportive? I mean, how are you finding it on the doorstep when you're going out in the northwest, which is the region you represent?
Actually, a lot of UK people are already out there knocking on doors, have been doing so for quite some time.
Yeah.
The very clear distinction is that those who are supportive of leaving the European Union are very striking. They're very dominant. They want to work really hard to get out there.
Yeah.
The key messages that the government wants to do are fear. Are those that we hear on the door, that we will be impoverished, that Britain would never be able to trade, that if we leave the European Union, somehow businesses would decide never to deal with Britain whatsoever again. Those are the messages that you hear from those who want to remain. But there are still quite a lot out there who are undecided. And the key things that we say to them is that you can't control your prosperity for the future. You can't make big decisions that will impact your children and grandchildren. You can't have the control of your own life if you can't do so. And that, actually, outside the world, we've got a very big world.
Yeah.
You know, we could look after our own research. You can expand our own universities to enable people to go to different parts of the world. You can change your immigration policy to be much more fair and equal to everybody. You can have trade agreements with different countries. But when we tell them that the NHS potentially could be privatised because of TTIP,
really?
That makes a massive difference, because the NHS is something fundamentally different to every other country in the world. It keeps us safe, it helps us be whole, and to be honest, we know through the TTIP documents at the moment that this could lead to the privatisation of the NHS, and when people hear that, then they say that's a big difference to them. They want to vote to leave.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of the countries in the European Union organise their healthcare differently. So, of course, TTIP just will not have that sort of impact on their health care services, because they are already in the private sector, or it's insurance-based and so on. And so Britain is, in so many ways, we are unique within the European Union. We do things in a different way. And the things that sort of happen over here in Brussels, we're not a good fit for the European Union. We're an awkward fit, that we don't fit their way of going. And what's happening with TTIP and our NHS is just another example of that. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's another reason why people should be voting to leave the European Union.
Well, you're quite right that there are good healthcare models in France in relation to heart services, in terms of Germany, in terms that they've got a very good primary care service, in terms of Sweden and Finland, that they also have some good areas as well. But all of them are based around the very simple premise of actually having an element of a privatised and private insurance system that works in the European Union. We're very unique in that level.
Yeah.
And it's also very different to that of the United States of America, where there is a very clear private healthcare system with very big corporates in terms of the hospitals, in terms of the provisions of different services, whether it's those who are looking after physiotherapy or mental health care, where they actually buy in those services themselves. And they're the type of industries and parts of the industry that want to come over and privatise the NHS to have our physiotherapy paid for them, to have these buildings of the hospitals paid for out of the private sector. And so we would lose complete control. You know, PFI was big enough and bad enough for us, but actually the NHS would be deeply damaged by remaining in the European Union because of TTIP, and that is a message that we need to get out very strongly.
So basically, message to the voters out there that I'll be taking back from our trip to Brussels. If you care about the NHS, if you want to keep our National Health Service, vote Leave.
That's right. If you want your freedom back and be able to control your own parliament and have parliament sovereign, then you must leave. If you want to have prosperity and expand across the world and have your own trade agreements in which your government actually can enter into agreements with other countries that benefits jobs here, then you vote Leave. But if you want to ensure that your NHS is not privatised and has a free health service, not an international health service, controlled by large corporations from America or elsewhere, then you must leave the European Union and not vote to remain.
Brilliant. Okay, well, listen, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Pleasure.
I know you've got a piece of action. You've only just arrived in Brussels. You've got a load of meetings tomorrow. I better let you get off back to your bed. But thanks very much for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I'm standing in a square in Brussels. Nice sunny day, it must be said. About three sides of the square have got buildings that look like they're maybe late 19th century, got shops on the ground floor, offices or flats above. The fourth side of the square, however, is completely filled by an absolute monstrosity of a modern office block. It's about six stories tall, fronted with glass and concrete. Doesn't just fill one side of the square, stretches right the way out of sight along the side streets in both directions. Absolutely enormous, completely devoid of any style, elegance or grace. And that is the European Parliament. So this is where I've got to go. Now heading in to find security.
Has to go in the tray.
Everything?
Yeah.
Well, we managed to get through security and then we've walked across some very impressive spaces, huge foyer packed with modern sculpture, highly polished marble, which I'm reliably informed cost millions of pounds to fit this building out. We've now arrived in the main plenary chamber where all the MEPs sit when they're doing their main meetings. I'm standing on the balcony, which is, if you like, the public gallery. In front of me is a vast hemicycle of hundreds of chairs, each with its own desk. And right at the front, there's a sort of a little stage where I suppose the important people sit, all dominated by a very large European Union flag, the gold stars on a blue background. Anyway, I'm here with Miles, who works for the EFDD group. Miles, can you tell us a little bit about how this room works and what goes on here?
Yeah, so they hold the debates here for 2 half days. I think it's every month. And the layout of the chamber is quite literally as you expect. The far left of any political persuasion are quite literally on the left, moving right the way through to the Social Democrats and the European People's Party, which are the two largest parties within the European Parliament. Then you have the ECR, which covers the UK Conservative Party, moving through to the group I work for, which is EFDD, where UKIP is situated. Then you have ENF, which is Marie Le Pen's group, and that's the far right. And then you have several members of the Parliament who are not actually attached to any particular group, and they are just usually situated towards the back of the Parliament.
Oh.
But every MEP has their own designated seat. So
Okay. And who gets to sit on the stage at the front in those big comfy armchair things that seem to be dominating the whole room?
The one in the middle would be the President of the Parliament, so Martin Schulz, or any of the Vice Presidents. So they would act as the equivalent to the Speaker or Deputy Speaker of the House of Commons.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people who are sat to the right and left of him are the secretariat of, I think, the president's office. So they will actually help the president or vice president during the debate point out anybody who wishes to speak or anything that's called catch the eye, or if a member wants to raise a question, they'll raise what's called a blue card. And that they will then tell the president or the vice president, Mr. Smith would like to ask Mr. Jones a question.
Okay, and then ranged around the back wall of this large chamber, there are they sort of look like the hospitality suites of the sports ground. They're sort of glass-fronted little rooms with some nice chairs and so on in them, and numbers on the front. What's going on there?
Well, these are the translator booths, so every member state is translated into whatever language you wish. And whatever number is actually on the booth indicates the language that is being translated to. So number one is German.
No surprise there, is there?
No, absolutely not. Number two is our good old English.
Right.
Three, France. Four, Italian. Five, Netherlands. Six is Danish. Seven, I think, is Greek.
Uh-huh.
Eight, Spanish. Nine, Portuguese. And so on and so forth, right the way through. So all member states' native tongues are covered.
Oh, right, and is that like simultaneous translation as the debate's going on?
Yes, so? It is. Wow, yes, so you have to, there are usually three translators per booth,
uh-huh,
and they take it in turns throughout the debate.
Okay, but can I just pick you up on one thing you said right at the start? I mean, this is a huge building. It's very plushly appointed, obviously, with all the translator facilities. You know, there's a lot of high-tech gear going on here, and it's all beautifully, like I say, you know, the carpets and the chairs are all absolutely plush. Did I hear you say this is used for 2 half-days a month?
That's right, yes. Yeah. So we had a half-day session last week, and then the next half-day session is the end of May.
Because, you know, back home in the UK, you know, our parliament, it's not, you know, the parliament chamber at Westminster, it's nothing like as big as this. It's nothing like as luxurious as this. And it's used all the time. So, you know, for someone coming from the Brexit side of the debate, you know, I could look on this as an example of the massive waste within the European Union, that they've built this fantastic debating chamber, it's beautifully appointed, spent millions of pounds doing it up, and they only use it twice a month.
That's right, because the official seat of the European Union is Strasbourg, but that is only used for 1 week out of four. So the entire parliament decamps to Strasbourg at a cost of about €200 million a year.
No.
Yes, and that's, as I say, this. So Brussels is not the seat of the parliament. This is mainly where all the committee work is actually done, and the legislation is drawn up, and then everything is debated at the plenary in Strasbourg for a whole, what, for 4 days, 4.5 days, once a month. So,
why would you have two complete parliament buildings? And spend some time in one and some time in another. That just seems colossally expensive, unless there's a very good reason for it.
Well, it's part of the treaty was, I believe, that Strasbourg is the seat of the European Union. However, the Council and the Commission are based in Brussels for some odd reason. They felt that it would be prudent and convenient to have another parliament in Brussels near to the Commission and the Council.
Well, as I say, I think this is 200 million euros. This is just, you know, another example of how British taxpayers' money is wasted in the European Union. But anyway, having had a look at this marvellous debating chamber, you've promised me a very unusual cafe somewhere in this building. So
yes,
let's set off along these interminable corridors and try and get a cup of tea somewhere.
No worries. Great.
Right, well, after walking through further long corridors, we've arrived in this cafe, Miles, that you were telling me about. I'm absolutely amazed. There is a picture of Mickey Mouse on the wall, one of the great American icons. Really wasn't expecting to find that here in the European Parliament. Anyway, this is a lovely, big, airy room, lots of very comfortable armchairs and tables and so on. There's a good number of people here. I assume these are mainly staff here at the European Parliament.
Yeah, it's a mixture, but mainly staff come and sit here, and it's called the Mickey Mouse Bar, as you mentioned, because there's a big picture of Mickey Mouse, and the furniture is a mixture of yellow, blue, green and red chairs.
So, and they're very bright reds and yellows and greens, aren't they? This is
bright.
Real primary colour,
yes.
Stuff.
Yes, very, very much indeed, and there's a bar which serves coffees, alcoholic beverages, sandwiches, and the MEPs can just jump straight to the queue. They have
really?
A reserved area. Yes, yeah.
Oh, because we queued up to get our cups of tea. I must admit, we're not boozing, are we?
No.
Cup of tea. But we had to queue up, and like I say, it's quite busy here as well. But the MEPs can just, what, walk straight to the front of the queue?
Absolutely. There's a section right in the middle of the bar which is reserved for MEPs, and they can just go straight to the front. MEPs are treated with an enormous amount of deference here. They have chauffeur-driven Mercedes,
Is that what, when they're on official business?
Yes, somewhere. When they're on official business.
Okay.
Or just to take them to the airport or do the Eurostar or something
That's very nice for them, isn't it?
It is.
Presumably all paid for with our tax money.
Absolutely, yes. Yes.
No wonder so many of the Conservative and Labour MEPs don't want us to leave the European Union. It would mess up their nice lifestyle, wouldn't it?
It would indeed. It would indeed, yes. And then there's... as well as this bar, there's another coffee bar which is near the TV studio. Then you have the members have their own dining room, which is very, very plush. And then,
they've got their own dining room as well as being able to jump the queue here.
Yes, yes.
Good grief.
They can use the staff canteen as well as using their own dining room too.
Yeah.
I mean, there are small advantages for staff as well. If we're invited to the members' dining room by a member, we can obviously go along as well, but we can't just stroll in.
Oh, okay. Now, I must say, one thing I have noticed, just as we've been walking around, because we've been up and down corridors and so on, and now we're in this staff cafe, and I don't want to come across all snobbish or anything, but the standard of personal appearance and dress here is appalling. I mean, I'm just looking across the room here. There's a middle-aged gentleman there in jeans and a T-shirt, and yet this is, you know, the heart of the European project. This is supposedly the capital of the new European empire. But you go to Westminster Parliament, for instance, all the men are in suits, the ladies are nicely dressed, everyone's very presentable. But you come here, you look like you're in a holiday camp somewhere. It's astonishing.
Yeah, it is. You can pretty much tell sort of who are continental Europeans and who are from the UK. The UK MEPs or UK advisors are usually very, you know, suited and booted with ties and such like.
Well, I must say, you're wearing a very nice chalk stripe suit with a sort of blue and yellow striped tie. Very natty.
Thank you very much. Thank you, yeah. And then you find the sort of continental Europeans, I suppose, along with their casual attitude, dress casually. It's a very, very different thing. And as you quite rightly say, in Westminster, everybody's suited and booted. They probably have respect for the position that they're actually holding. And it's what's expected, really. So
yeah, because I must say, you know, just wandering around, this isn't somewhere that's coming across as having a very professional attitude to work. You know, when you go to office of a big company and so on, you know, everyone is, you know, walking around with a purpose. They're going somewhere because they're going somewhere. They're looking smart. They appear to be professional. But, you know, people just wander around aimlessly in casual clothes. It's really not what I was expecting at the powerhouse of the great European empire. Anyway, we've had a nice cup of tea now. Lottie and I have got to get off for some meetings and so on. So thank you very much for showing us around.
My pleasure.
Massively appreciated.
My pleasure.
We'll get off to some meetings and then we'll see what we can do once we've finished our hard day's work here, because we have got to slog our way through quite a few things. But Miles, thank you very much for showing us around. Greatly appreciated. And what a bizarre place to work.
It is indeed. Very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks. Right, well, we've finished our busy day of meetings in the European Parliament. We've now found a nice pavement cafe outside in the sunshine. I'm sitting here with Lottie having a drink after a pretty hard day in there. One of the things I found interesting was pretty much everyone that I spoke to in there didn't want to go on the record to come onto this podcast to talk about Britain leaving the European Union. Obviously, we were talking to a lot of functionaries in there, staff and so on, who were absolutely adamant that they did not want Britain to leave the European Union. But one of them gave a really interesting reason. He said that when Britain leaves the European Union and we go, he thought that the European Union itself would be in trouble and would have trouble coping and managing without Britain. Lottie, what did you make about that?
Oh, well, we're one of the biggest contributors to the budget, so if we go, it's going to leave a big financial... It's a black hole that it's going to need filling. Who is going to, you know, put more money in? Is it going to be the Germans? Is it going to be the Italians, the Greeks, and various countries? They're struggling economically at the moment.
Well, that's right, because... and also, I mean, it's not just Greece and places like Portugal, Spain, Italy have got sort of government financial problems. But a lot of other countries, so you're looking at maybe Romania, Bulgaria and so on, They are taking tens of millions of euros out of the European Union on a very regular basis, and in fact propping up their government spending. So, as you say, you know, if Britain leaves and we're not paying in our 11 billion a year, how many billions it is, you're right, either Germany's got to pay more, or those countries have got to take less out of the European Union, and that's going to make European Union membership a lot less attractive to them.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of regional development, across the various member states, you see spending, but if we are no longer contributing to that budget, that is going to reduce. And you're going to see funding across the whole of the European Union starting to dry up. It's just going to cause serious problems for the EU as a whole.
Well, that's right. I mean, the other thing I must say really impressed me in that one, it's a terribly modern building. But it is incredibly plush. You know, just the quality of the furniture and the modern art that they've got in there. That alone must cost absolutely millions. We finished our, if you like, the business meetings for the day inside the European Parliament. So we'll have our drink here in the pavement cafe. And then we're meeting a couple of MEPs for dinner tonight, I believe.
Yes, we are. Yeah, we've got a table booked, and a group of us will be going. We'll be having discussions about the campaign and relaxing after a very stressful day.
Some of those meetings really were quite brain-numbing, weren't they? And also, you know, the other thing is they were so talking that, you know, their internal jargon and just assuming you understood, all the different initials and acronyms they were using. It really was a bit of a stressful day. But anyway, you're quite right. Anyway, we'll have a drink and then we'll go out for dinner and see what the evening has to hold for us. Right, we're now in the Positano restaurant just around the corner from the European Parliament building. I've met Julia Reid, who is UKIP MEP for South West England. We've been having a little chat about the European Union's relationship with countries out in Eastern Europe and the effect that might have on Britain if we vote to stay within the European Union. So, first of all, Julia, which countries are covered by this Eastern Partnership scheme?
The Eastern Partnership, it's Georgia, Moldova, the Ukraine, Armenia, Azerbaijan and Belarus. And the first agreement was signed in 2009.
Uh-huh.
That was the beginning of the Eastern Partnership. And then there's been a accord agreement signed recently between Ukraine, Georgia and Moldova.
Okay, because, I mean, some of these countries, I've not been to them, I don't know, but some of them have a reputation for having quite corrupt systems of government, and rule of law isn't very strong. But also, of course, they produce massive amounts of agricultural produce, which might be coming into the European Union system and common agricultural policy. Are there any issues surrounding that, do you think?
Well, we have already been receiving letters from the National Farmers Union concerned about the fact that the Ukraine can produce milk a lot cheaper than what our farmers can in the UK, and as we all know, dairy farmers in the UK are struggling at the moment, and also the amount of grain that they grow.
Yep.
So this will be a problem. But at the moment, the agreement that's been signed is a free trade agreement of sorts, and it's also what they call ever-deepening relationships.
Uh-huh.
To bring these countries into a political sphere of the European Union. So once the six countries that currently have membership applications ongoing, which are Albania, Serbia, Bosnia, Turkey, Kosovo, and the other one that escapes me at the moment. So one would assume that the six Eastern Partnership countries will be at the next stage.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Because this is what the European Union wants to do. It wants to become bigger and increase its sphere of influence. And at the moment, as you know, Rupert, in the European Commission, the UK only has influence of 4%.
That's right.
In the European Council, we only have 12.5%. And in the European Parliament, we only have 9.7%.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, under the Lisbon Treaty, 751 is the maximum number of MEPs that
correct.
We have. So as each one of these countries joins in the future, 5-10 years down the line, the UK will lose even more MEPs. We used to have 83, then we had 78, now we only have 73.
And some of these countries actually, I mean, most of them are European, but they are pushing the border, if they were to join the European Union, would be pushing its borders into some fairly unstable parts of the world. We've already seen what's happened in the Ukraine with Vladimir Putin and Russia turning nasty about the Crimea. Turkey, which I understand is also one that might be coming up for membership, has got a border with Syria where there's a civil war going on. And so, you know, this could potentially turn the European Union from, if you like, a fairly safe club of European countries into actually somewhere that's got borders with some very unstable parts of the world. And also, a lot of these countries have got large populations that are very poor. And of course, they might be looking to Western European countries as somewhere they can move to and try and get well-paid jobs, which would only exacerbate the migrant crisis we've got at the moment.
Well, I would say they wouldn't need to be well-paid jobs, because as with Bulgaria and Romania, the minimum wage is between £200 and £250 a month,
yep.
compared with the minimum wage in the United Kingdom, which is heading up towards £2,000. But even further east, the minimum wage, if they have one, is going to be even less.
Yes.
So people from these countries are only too pleased to come to the United Kingdom and take jobs for the minimum wage or less, which, as we've seen, has led to wage compression in the United Kingdom.
That's right, which of course particularly affects the lower end of the income scale. So people that are just leaving school, starting on their careers, or people that are in low-paid jobs. Okay, well, listen, I know I interrupted you because we were having dinner here and you were having dinner here, so it's a bit of a cheek to grab you. But thanks very much for spending time to talk to us.
Thank you for a short stop in Sharlingers Hill. Please remember to take all your baggage with you. It is very important that you have your ticket ready for inspection. Thank you for traveling with Eurostar today. We wish you a pleasant evening. Pidonen, Kilmington, Kovanine, Reissel. On the stop is Van Courtedur,
Well, as you can hear, we're on our way home. I think that was actually a very interesting trip to Brussels and the European Parliament. I doubt I really need my views reinforced that we ought to vote leave on the 23rd of June. But it was interesting to pick up a few other bits of information, particularly the views of continentals, who, of course, want us to stay. But also the reason for doing so, especially a chap who seemed to think the European Union itself might get into some sort of difficulties were we to go. Anyway, there we go. Very interesting trip. Back to the campaign and the pavement slogging back in Britain.